Klein had Peter put on a hat with a very simple but powerful eye-tracking device composed of two tiny cameras. One camera recorded the movement of Peter's fovea, the centerpiece of his eye. The other camera recorded whatever it was Peter was looking at, and then the two images were superimposed. This meant that on every frame of the movie, Klein could draw a line showing where Peter was looking at that moment. He then had people without autism watch the movie as well, and he compared Peter's eye movements with theirs. In one scene, for example, Nick, George Siegel, is making polite conversation, and he points to the wall of host George's, Richard Burton's, study, and asks, "Who did the painting?" The way you and I would look at that scene is straightforward. Our eyes would follow in the direction that Nick is pointing, alight on the painting, swivel back to George's eyes to get his response, and then return to Nick's face to see how he reacts to the answer. All of that takes place in a fraction of a second, and on Klein's visual scanning pictures, the line representing the gaze of the normal viewer forms a clean, straight-edged triangle from Nick to the painting to George and then back again to Nick. Peter's pattern, though, is a little different. He starts somewhere around Nick's neck, but he doesn't follow the direction of Nick's arm because interpreting a pointing gesture requires, if you think about it, that you instantaneously inhabit the mind of the person doing the pointing. You need to read the mind of the pointer, and of course, people with autism can't read minds. Children respond to pointing gestures by the time they are 12 months old, Klein said. This is a man who is 42 years old and very bright, and he's not doing that. Those are the kind of cues that children are learning naturally, and he just doesn't pick up on them. So what does Peter do? He hears the words painting and wall, so he looks for paintings on the wall. But there are three in the general vicinity. Which one is it? Klein's visual scanning pictures show Peter's gaze moving frantically from one picture to the other. Meanwhile, the conversation has already moved on. The only way Peter could have made sense of that scene is if Nick had been perfectly verbally explicit. If he had said, "Who did that painting to the left of the man and the dog?" In anything less than a perfectly literal environment, the autistic person is lost. There's another critical lesson in that scene. The normal viewers looked at the eyes of George and Nick when they were talking, and they did that because when people talk, we listen to their words and watch their eyes in order to pick up on all those expressive nuances that Ekman has so carefully cataloged. But Peter didn't look at anyone's eyes in that scene. At another critical moment in the movie, when in fact George and Martha, Elizabeth Taylor, are locked in a passionate embrace, Peter looked not at the eyes of the kissing couple, which is what you or I would do, but at the light switch on the wall behind them. That's not because Peter objects to people or finds the notion of intimacy repulsive. It's because if you cannot mind read, if you can't put yourself in the mind of someone else, then there's nothing special to be gained by looking at eyes and faces. One of Klein's colleagues at Yale, Robert T. Schultz, once did an experiment with what is called an fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imagery, a highly sophisticated brain scanner that shows where the blood is flowing in the brain at any given time, and hence which part of the brain is in use. Schultz put people in the fMRI machine and had them perform a very simple task in which they were given either pairs of faces or pairs of objects, such as chairs or hammers, and they had to press a button indicating whether the pairs were the same or different. Normal people, when they were looking at the faces, used a part of their brain called the fusiform gyrus, which is an incredibly sophisticated piece of brain software that allows us to distinguish among the literally thousands of faces that we know. Picture in your mind the face of Marilyn Monroe. You just used your fusiform gyrus. When the normal participants looked at the chair, however, they used a completely different and less powerful part of the brain, the inferior temporal gyrus, which is normally reserved for objects. The difference in the sophistication of those two regions explains why you can recognize Sally from the eighth grade 40 years later, but have trouble picking out your bag on the airport luggage carousel. When Schultz repeated the experiment with autistic people, however, he found that they used their object recognition area for both the chairs and the faces. In other words, on the most basic neurological level, for someone with autism, a face is just another object.